Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
As New York Times bestseller, winner of 2 Pulitzer Prizes, the National Book Award, and the Carnegie Medal for Fiction, among many other accolades, Colton Whitehead is certainly one of America's most successful contemporary writers. Described as America's storyteller, his stories resonate across the years, shedding light on the roots of America's contemporary racial injustices. He's speaking at the London Book Fair later this month. His next book, Crook Manifesto, will continue his Harlem saga in a powerful novel that summons 1970s New York in all its seedy glory. He joins me now. Colson, are you with us? I know we were having a bit of a problem with your line. Are you there?
I'm here, Hattie. I hope you can hear me.
Oh, great. I absolutely can. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to, first of all, welcome you to the show, and secondly, give you a heads up that I've been asking all our listeners today about their nostalgia food from childhood, because I've just come back from Norway and I just spent the whole week there. I'm half Norwegian, gorging on pickled herrings. So later on, I might ask you for your nostalgia food from childhood, but I'm going to let you mull that while we talk.
I'll get working on it. Sounds good.
You get to work on that. And I'm going to ask you about the London Book Fair, which you're attending later this month. I think you're going to be speaking with Colin Grant, the British-Jamaican author. And I wondered what you're looking forward to discussing with him at the festival, and how you know, similar and how dissimilar your experiences are. You know, he's a British, his books are written from a sort of British-Jamaican perspective. Yours, of course, from an African-American perspective. Are there commonalities?
We're two different people. So,
of course.
I try to do my own thing. And, I've written across different genres. Sometimes I use realism, sometimes fabulism. Sometimes I'm writing about the South, sometimes the big city. So for me, I try to mix it up and not try to do one thing. And so far, it's been working.
Absolutely. So what will you unpick in your conversation together?
For my part, I'm engaged in this series about New York City in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And so I've done a sort of deep archaeology of my hometown. I follow one main character named Ray Carney, a fence, someone who deals in stolen goods over the course of decades. So hopefully I'm going to get into his story and how his life reflects the city. The city reflects his own personal journey over a couple of decades and take it from there.
And is it fair to say that you've really just written one particularly autobiographical novel in terms of Sag Harbor?
Sag Harbor is about growing up in the 1980s in Long Island. And when it first came out, I would say it was semi-autobiographical. In the 12 years since, I think nobody really cares. So I'm happy to say it's autobiographical. And in that book, talking about childhood foods, there's a big sort of 5-page section on frozen dinners. I was a latchkey kid, which meant I would come home from school, my parents wouldn't be there, and my brother and I would fend for ourselves. So there's a loving recreation of late 1970s frozen food, whether it was fried chicken with mashed potatoes or boil-in-bag turkey tetrazzini and rice. And so my nostalgic food of childhood would be those frozen TV dinners, which were not very healthy, but did the trick in terms of of putting a meal on a plate.
Yeah, it's funny how many I'm getting from the 70s. A lot of contenders for Angel Delight. I don't know if you ever had that in America.
No, that sounds pretty fabulous.
It's pretty disgusting. Just add water and there you've got instant dessert. But you were quite unusual, I guess, in terms of your upbringing, insofar as you were a well-to-do African-American family and you went to private schools, which must have made you feel a little bit sort of set apart, even in youth.
Well, I mean, you know, I always had a lot of black friends, and you know, to me, it was not weird. I had a lot of, you know, black friends who went to public school, to private school, and I do write about the sort of culture clash in my autobiographical book, but it's really more to get at a metaphor for America and how separate we are, how together we are. The book is about a black teenager coming into his identity, but it's really about being a teenager in general. So you can relate to it whether, no matter what kind of upbringing you have. It's about identity formation, where you end and your community begins, your family begins. It's about coming into a self. And so in terms of the main character in that book, part of that identity formation comes between sorting white culture from black culture. But in the end, you know, he sort of realizes that everyone's faking it, no matter what, where you're coming from, what skin color you are. So it does start in a very specific kind of way and quickly becomes universal because we can all relate to his struggles to define himself.
As you've said, you've written in many different genres. I've only recently completed The Nickel Boys, which is perhaps... Can I describe it as brutalist to an extent? I mean, I read the opening two pages and thought, I really don't want to read this, but I absolutely have to. And it felt like that all the way through it. It completely overwhelmed me, sucked me in, but at the same time, you know, is quite confronting because of the fact, not least, that it's based on a true story. Tell me a little bit about why about that book and what prompted it.
Well, similarly, I didn't want to write it, but I had to. So the source material stayed with me. And, you know, as time goes by, if an idea stays with you, it's arguing for its viability as a project. So it takes off from a real life case. There was a juvenile detention center called the Dozier School in Florida. It was open for 100 years. And the idea was very lofty, you know, instead of locking up teenage offenders with grown-ups, well, if we had a separate facility where they can learn a trade, go to school, and when they get out, they can rejoin society. But as usual, when you get humans involved, a good idea degrades pretty quickly. So there was a lot of abuse, sexual, physical, and some kids went missing. And when the school finally closed, they found a secret graveyard where the kids who had supposedly run away were actually buried. So I came across the story in the news, and I was shocked I never heard about it. It was a national story for one day. And I started thinking about what kind of story I could get out of the black part of campus. There were black and white kids there, but all the survivors who came forward were white. And so there was a story of the black part of campus that kept talking to me. It's a grim story. It's a true story. Jim Crow. The Jim Crow period in American history picked up from the legacy of slavery in terms of black control, inequality. So whereas some of my books have a lot of jokes, this book didn't really have a lot of room for jokes at all. You know, I try to mix it up and sometimes deal with more lofty topics. Sometimes I'm in for the book to tell some low jokes. But either way, those are both parts of our lives.
But the thing I think that was, I mean, the story itself is horrific, but we've heard many similar horrific stories. I suppose, to an extent, the thing that was most upsetting to me was that your young, upright, bookish character, Elwood, you know, suffers this extreme miscarriage of justice. And his most prized possession up until the point he's incarcerated in this reform school is this recording of Martin Luther King. And he believes King's words, and he believes, you know, forgiveness and being upright and holding your head high and we'll love you till you change, you know, and all of those dictums. But actually, the book you've written is in many ways quite a hopeless one.
I think it depends on your perspective. You know, there are two kids who are at the school, and you can't really come out of that kind of school intact unless you have hope. And so there is, for me, this animating belief and hope in salvation that animates the story and also gives the kids purpose. And so how do you deal with a world that is merciless, that is cruel? What kind of personal reserves do you draw upon? What kind of lies do you invent to keep you going? It takes place in the early 60s, and Dr. King's message is transforming American society. Do we believe those ideas wholeheartedly, or do we have to question them given the reality of the times?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
And what do you feel? I mean, you've written these novels, all of them in their way, you know, absolutely brilliantly immersive fiction, but also morality tales to an extent, or campaigning books to an extent. And yet I think by your own assertion, you know, politicians don't read fiction or don't read books. So do you hope to achieve something? You said you write in the African-American literary tradition. Do you hope to achieve something with them, or are you reluctant to be a spokesperson and happy to be a writer?
Well, there's a few things there. In terms of the messages in the book, they're open to interpretation. In terms of my ideas of where we're going as a society, I'm very negative. I don't really see a lot of progress happening in my lifetime. And that idea is sometimes present in the books, sometimes not. I step outside of myself to talk about the world and whether the book has a more hopeful or optimistic message or more pessimistic message. Those are both parts of the human experience. And they have nothing to do with me personally. And in terms of being a spokesperson, I'm just a weird guy in my apartment thinking up weird stories. And if people come to them and enjoy them, if I do it in the right way and people come along, I'm very happy. If they're not as accessible, you know, perhaps the next one will be. So I feel I'm writing for myself, trying to do the best project that's illuminating and enlightening for me at that time. And sometimes they're political and sometimes they're not.
I was reading this article the other day about reparations, and in particular reparations for the slavery, of course, and reading the Nickel Boys, you know, one of the things that struck me is how do you make up for the experience that these people have had, that these boys in this particular story have had? What are your feelings on that?
You don't make up for it, and no one's really interested, so it'll never happen. It's funny because
I mean there is movement. There's more conversation around it as a possibility. I mean, governments and institutions have started to pay at least lip service to the idea that there is something to be atoned for.
Sure, lip service, but I think there's more energy preventing any kind of real progress on that. It's funny because I never had a conversation about reparations in America. It's only when I talk to European journalists that it comes up.
Really?
So maybe there's a more conversation in Europe about reparations, but I don't think anybody here has any kind of realistic notion that the government will be held accountable for anything it does, whether it's in the present or in the past.
So how do you change the dynamic? You say that you're pessimistic about the future. And as I said, atonement is necessary. Clearly, I mean, to pluck this Nickel Boy story out of so many, many millions of stories, you know, it is a shocking tale. What do we have to do to change society?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to be a negative Nelly, bring everybody down.
It's lunchtime here.
I think it's, you know, the one thing that does give me hope is that sort of younger generation. I think my Gen X generation, the baby boomers, the greatest generation, have done a really good job of screwing things up. But when I see how engaged a lot of our young people are, it does give me at least some sort of dim notion that they can maybe attack and some of the problems we've left them with, and perhaps things might get a little brighter. But definitely, I've given up on my generation.
That's very sad. And as a double Pulitzer Prize winner, as I've been saying all morning in anticipation of talking to you, and having been described as America's storyteller, they sound like, you know, of course, amazing accolades, but also heavy burdens for a man who maybe just wants to tell stories.
Well, I mean, you know, I've been writing for 25 years and publishing fiction and nonfiction. And sometimes you're up and sometimes you're down. Sometimes a book or project will reach readers and sometimes they'll ignore it. So in terms of the burden of some of the nice things I've had happen to me the last couple of years, I'm always humbled by the blank page the next day. And so whether things are going right or poorly in your career, the work never gets easier. So that keeps me grounded. It's a challenge. And then also, luckily, there's that day-to-day pleasure of the work, discovering a new kind of sentence, something about a character. So whether things are going well or bad, just keep going on. If I could do something else, I would, but I haven't found that yet.
Do you think you're writing in the African-American tradition or creating an African-American
tradition? You know, I did say that in an interview 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. It stayed with me. It was sort of
these things do, as you know.
So I was being a bit pretentious because I was thinking about my literary ancestors, whether it's Jean Toomer or Ralph Ellison or Toni Morrison. I think I discovered pretty quickly I was making my own weird path. I think because of the people who went before me, there's no one Black novel to write. A lot of my peers were all doing different things, and I think that's really great. There's not just one Black artist, one James Baldwin, one Toni Morrison. We have this great diversity in our community now where we can tell all kinds of stories.
Tell me then about Crook Manifesto, which sadly I haven't had a chance to read yet because it's not out till July here, I think. And I didn't get to, I didn't manage to get my hands on a copy, but it is a return, I think, the second installment of your Harlem saga. You grew up in the Upper East Side. Did that mean that Harlem seemed like this kind of faraway, unreachable, glorious place?
Yeah, I lived all over the city when I was a tiny child. I lived in Harlem until I was 6 years old. So obviously I don't remember much about it. It does take place, the book, in the 1960s and 1970s. So that meant a lot of historical research and immersing myself in the time. And it was great. Research. I felt very connected to New York City. I felt connected to Harlem, which I was recreating. In the end, you know, I've sort of talked to some people and they want to know why everybody is a criminal. Where are the good people of Harlem? And you know, it's not a documentary. It's about a bunch of criminal types in New York City, and not really representative of most people in Harlem or New York City. So it's a portrait of a character and a time. And I've never done a sequel before. I've never explored a character over, say, 1,000 pages. So it's been a really great thing to find a new way of writing, you know, 25 years in, and a new way of telling stories.
Just finally, I think you said your father had or was apocalyptic in his racial view of America. It does sound, from talking to you today, that you may have inherited that.
Well, it's not really much to be cheerful about. So I don't feel it's my job to make people feel good about the world. I tell like I see it, and the news is often pretty terrible.
Explain to me what that means for you, because obviously we're coming, as you know, as we talked in the beginning about the fact you're coming here to have this conversation with a British Jamaican, you're talking as an African American. Explain to me what that means in terms of being a Black American at this point in our history.
Well, it seems, you know, I mean, I can only speak for myself. It means trying to carve out a little space of joy through your friends and your family. Hopefully you have a job that is meaningful to you, because you're going to spend a lot of hours during the day doing that job. So the world is not necessarily an incredibly wholesome place. If you can carve out a little bit of space for joy in your life, that seems to be a major accomplishment.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.